The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Good morning. Looks like we're about ready to get started. Zakhar Siddiqui. On behalf of the Islamic Legal Forum at Washington College of Law and the National Muslim Law Student Association and the Center for Global Peace at American University, I'd like to welcome you to day two of Islamic Law in the West, Theory, Doctrine, and Practice. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge our supporters. Of course, here at the Washington College of Law, we have the Office of Special Events and the Founders Committee. Also, the All Dulles Area Muslims, the Adams Center and its members, the International Institute for Islamic Thought, and the Department of International Peace and Conflict Resolution at American University. This morning, we're going to have Professor Mumtaz Ahmed moderating our panel for Islam, War, and Politics. Professor Mumtaz Ahmed is a professor of political science at Hampton University, and he is the former president of the Association of American Muslim Social Scientists and the current president of the South Asian Muslim Studies Association. He is co-editor of the Journal of Studies in Contemporary Islam. Professor Mumtaz Ahmed.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's my pleasure to be here and moderate this panel. It's a very important panel, deals with the very significant topic, Islam, war, and politics. Somehow or the other, since the name of Islam is associated with war rather than peace and justice, we are very fortunate to have a wonderful panel this morning, consisting of Professor Muhammad Fadhel and Professor Shahid Alam and Professor Abdul Karim Bangura. I'll introduce the speakers, but let me briefly introduce the topic that is the core of this panel. This panel essentially will examine the historical trajectory of wars affecting both the theory and practice emanating from the House of Islam. There will be a short exposition of the classical Islamic position on issues such as just war and jihad, as well as some discussion of the practice of early Islam with regard to armed struggles. The major portion of the panel will address more contemporary issues dealing with modern wars as they relate to the world of Islam, and particular emphasis will be, hopefully, on recent Muslim discourse and political practice that emerged in the context of the tragedy of 9/11 and the war on terror, quote unquote. The panelists are leading public intellectuals who are deeply enmeshed in the debates around the issues addressed in this panel this morning. Let me introduce the panelists and then we'll proceed in the order in which I will introduce. Professor Abdul Karim Bangura will go first, and then Professor Shahid Alam, and finally, not the least, will go Professor Muhammad Fadhel. Let me introduce Professor Abdul Karim Bangura, who is a professor at the School of International Service, American University. He's a Muslim, but he has a varied experience of having been educated in the broader Abrahamic tradition. As a child, he went to a Roman Catholic school and served as an altar boy. Imagine that, in Sierra Leone, which is his home country. And then he also studied with very prominent rabbis in Italy. What more you can expect from a person with the broader Abrahamic tradition? Bangura holds a BA in social sciences, international studies, a master's degree in international affairs, a graduate diploma in social sciences from Stockholm University, and a graduate diploma also in social sciences, a PhD in development economics, and a master's in linguistics. He has how many? Three? Four PhDs. Okay. He has a PhD in development economics, a PhD in linguistics, and a PhD in computer science. He's currently working on his PhD in microbiology, Islamic hermeneutics, optical physics. He's a very well-published, very prolific writer. He has taught at Georgetown University, Harvard University, several other colleges, and he's the author and editor of 53 books and still counting, 400 scholarly articles. He's still very young, and we hope to see another 47 at least books more to hit a century. Professor Shahid Alam is a professor of economics at Northeastern University in Boston. His writings have appeared in leading economic journals, including Economic Development and Cultural Change, Southern Economic Journal, Journal of Development Economics, American Economic Review, Cambridge Journal of Economics, and Studies in Contemporary Islam, a journal that your most obedient servant happens to be the editor. He has published many books, including Poverty from the Wealth of Nations, Governments and Markets in Economic Development Strategies, and Is There an Islamic Problem? That was published a couple of years ago. Let me also add that his most recent book, Challenging the New Orientalism, is available outside the registration desk, and I encourage all of you to buy the book. Of course, you must insist that he signs the book, and let me also assure you that he hasn't promised me any commission for that. Then, last but not the least, we are already familiar with the wonderful presentation by Dr. Muhammad Fadal that we had yesterday. He's a professor at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law, and before joining the academia, he practiced law, and he clerked with very prominent federal judges in the United States and worked with a law firm based in New York. He has a JD degree from the University of Virginia School of Law, but I think his most important accomplishment is his PhD from the University of Chicago, my alma mater, and the alma mater of Professor Dr. Omar Farooq. He wrote his dissertation on the at the University of Chicago on the legal processes in medieval Islamic law, and in addition to giving regular public lectures in Islamic law, he has published numerous papers in this area. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are fortunate in having wonderful panelists. Let me also say that Professor Bengura will be speaking on Islam and just war theory, and Dr. Shahid Alam will be speaking on, quote, unquote, Islamic terror, images and reality, and the topic of Professor Fadal's presentation is Islam and the obligations of citizenship. Professor Bengura will go first, then Professor Shahid Alam, and then Professor Fadal. I give the stage to. Before we begin, can I request the speakers to limit their remarks to between 20 to 20 minutes so that we have enough time for discussion? Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Why would this wonderful folk convert to Islam? Is it because Islam is a warmonger religion? Or is it because Islam is a peaceful religion? I think that's the fundamental question. Good. Can you hear me? Okay, much better. No? They say 4 inches.
Okay, much better? All right. Who is this guy? Guy Stevens? Anybody know this one? Ronnie O'Sullivan, world champion pool. The great Peter Saunders. Rad Hoffman, German ambassador. The great ex-Christian minister, Joseph Estes, Imam Joseph Estes now. Amina Aslimi, former radical feminist. Lord Headley, British statesman, editor. Mario Schialoja, Italian ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Lieutenant Heda Ramaha, U.S. Navy. Yvonne Ridley of The Guardian. Anybody know this one? You should. General Charles Buchanan, nephew of former U.S. President James Buchanan. They all had one thing in common, which is what? Convert to Islam. Of course, the great mathematician Jeffrey Lange, Kansas State University. Keith Ellison, who took his oath on Thomas Jefferson's own Quran. Even though he was a supremacist in Virginia, insisted that he should not even be in Congress. Boom! The name of Prophet Muhammad. In the name of Allah, boom! And the world knows the rest of the story. It replaced every night on our television sets across the globe. First bodies are counted. Tears are broadcast to boost ratings. And hearts and stomachs are assaulted just after prime time. Retaliations and recriminations are to follow. And more explosions in the name of another ideal, democracy. That is remarkably similar, yet calculated precisely not to mean to seem so. Until today, we hear again what? Another boom. The cycle repeats itself. Meanwhile, where are the analyses? First, we get our politicians, whose purposive behavior is for what? To get re-elected. So they are pilloried in front of our TV sets, to gain votes, and we know the rest of the story of the epithet that I use against Muslims and Islam. And then corporate media. It's good now they are feeling guilty for sitting on the sidelines until all the lies we are told, all the tricks, all the games for us to engage in wars that we Americans had no business engaging in. But more disturbing are the pseudo-intellectuals. And I was in a conference not too long ago. And that goes not only for non-Muslims, sometimes even Muslims, who, in their bid to feel good, to feel accepted, to get a limelight, to be on TV, sometimes are even more vicious in downgrading or saying things that are really un-Islamic against Islam. So therefore, what is war? Since I'm supposed to give the broad brush. Of course, there are a series of wars. The solution is to examine the very sources of where these wars emerge. And some of the theories that undergird the reason why we talk about these wars. War of attrition is usually bloody and can only be measured in terms of ground forces. You have war of maneuver. War of maneuver is fought to destroy the enemy's ability or will to fight. And then there's war of revolution. Quite bloody
as the other two with a different purpose. Sometimes it's referred to as guerrilla war. Why? Because it seeks to change the status quo. And then there is what we call nowadays Islamic war, whatever that is. But we know that war as a concept is loaded with linguistic and cultural symbolism. So therefore, we need to deal with what is referred to Islamic war today. And that would be the rest of the discourse. But for now, let's deal with the theories that have been proffered in terms of war. Of course, those of you who are political scientists or international relations scholars are quite familiar with political realism, emanating from Hobbes' perspective that man by his very nature is what? Evil. Therefore, life in the Republic is what? Short, nasty, and British. Not brutish, British. When I say that in Britain, the British almost get my name. So therefore, the reality is rationalism. So you do whatever you have to do to make sure you come out the winner. And then there is the idealist or moral idealism that say, yes, there are problems, but we can find ways to solve these problems. And sometimes we even need war, only if it's justified, only if we think the objectives are kosher, as my Jewish brothers would say, but no far different from the realists. And they have the self-defense theory that says if you strike, you hit back hard. And if you cannot, make sure you get some good allies, just like the kid in the schoolyard who pays his lunch to the biggest bully to make sure he's protected, he's defended. And then there is the pacifist. The pacifist that says, no war, completely a bad thing, don't engage in it, stay away. If they slap you on one cheek, turn the other cheek and get slapped again. But then the critics will say sooner or later you're going to run out of cheeks, then what? And the last but not the least is just war theory. And this is where Islam is anchored. Just war theory is based on moral normativism. It faces more restrictions. And the United Nations chapter, Article 51, makes it very clear. A country that initiates a war for the purposes of self-defense, and in Article 7 of the United Nations, which qualifies a threat to international security and peace as a justification to engage in a war. So therefore, when I teach the course Islam and Human Rights, I usually point that all the articles, international covenants and human rights are in the Quran, and I usually juxtapose the pages in the Quran and the article, and I tell them there are 48 more human rights precepts in the Quran that the international body would never touch. For example, in the Quran there is a human right to struggle against corruption. But which country on earth is ever going to pass a law to stop corruption? Of course, we in the United States, we are not corrupt. Everybody else is corrupt. All we do is what? Lobby. So what are these Islamic precepts of war? First, we have to understand its meaning. What do we mean by Islamic? One thing that many of us conflate is sometimes we try to separate Islam from the state. And as we read Matthew, when Prophet Jesus came to Jerusalem and he found illegal trading, he responded the way true prophet, may peace be upon him, could respond by challenging those who were profiteering and cheating the common folk. So one of the men came up to him and showed him a coin. He said, "But Jesus, look at this coin. On the face of this coin is Caesar. Now whose law should I live by?" And of course, Prophet Jesus, may peace be upon him, being the pragmatist that he is, what did he say in Matthew 14:2? "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and unto God that which is God's." So he said, go ahead and live the way you believe in your life, as long as you don't violate the teachings of Christianity, of the message I'm bringing, then there's no problem. Islam, on the other hand, does not do that. Why? Because Islam is a complete way of life, total way of life. So imagine me being in the Dominican Republic, we are on the catamaran, partying, eating, listening to music, drinking my Coke. All of a sudden we got to Islas del Boca. So this guy realized I wasn't drinking the vodka. And then he said, "Try some of this vodka, it's good for you." I said, "No, I cannot do that." He said, "Why not?" I said, "I'm a Muslim." He said, "Ah, you're now on vacation." So you are 24/7, complete way of life. Islam's logical conditions. One of the things we argue, and sometimes folks want to juxtapose the teachings of scholars, all kind of wonderful theories, Ijtihad and all the schools and all this wonderful, great. Because Islam never discourage knowledge, the development of knowledge. Matter of fact, we Muslims like to brag that if Galileo had lived under an Islamic state, nothing would have happened to him. Because it's encouraged. The Quran itself is full of teachings, of precepts, scientific discoveries that are stated in the Quran 1500 years ago that we are just now discovering. That's another lecture in itself. But the logic is that all of those interpretations, all of those teachings should not take precedence over what is written in the Quran or the Hadith or the Bible and the Torah, because the Quran tells us that the Torah and the Bible are also our sources for knowledge, our sources for living. We cannot preempt them. Why? Because Muslims take very seriously the fact that the Quran is a revealed text. It's a revelation. Therefore, it has precedence over all our interpretation, all our scholarships that we do. And of course, the Hadith is very clear with its 9 criteria for scientific acceptance of a Hadith, that even the stories, the same, the teachings of the Prophet that we are shared, should be confirmed, should be validated through the Quran itself. Thus, we are very adamant in our choices. And as I said, Islamic sources, the Quran, the Hadith, the Book of Jacobs, the Torah, the Bible, this is written in the Quran itself. So this is a religion that validates its Abrahamic sisters and even urges us as Muslims to be familiar, to read, to understand the sources. Social justice, then, is the core of Islam. And of course, we don't need to spend too much time on the issue of jihad. This is one of those concepts that is completely misused in the media and by politicians. The jihadists have struck again. They are engaged in jihad just because Osama bin Laden and others decided to use the word. But we have to go beyond that. I know that jihad just means struggle. It has nothing to mean war, because in Arabic we have a word for war, which is what? Arabic. So imagine I'm in a conference, somebody's talking about Islamic fundamentalism. What the hell is an Islamic fundamentalist? Islam is the least religion that have the least number of sects, Sunni and Shiite. So if we accept the concept of fundamentalism, what are we saying? There are Sunni fundamentalists and non-fundamentalists, and there are Shiite fundamentalists and non-Shiite fundamentalists. What the hell is that? So we have to really start challenging these concepts and say jihad is not holy war. no matter who uses it to justify what they are doing. Debunking jihad means only one myth, lesson from Arabic and Islamic saints. Now I'll put on my linguistic hat. Terms used in old traditional Arabic for acts of vilification or aggression was to behave ignorantly, meaning recklessly, provocatively, or like immature, irresponsible kids. The great Arabic saying, let no one play the fool with us, for then we would outdo the folly of the ignorant. Noble Arabs did not indulge in aggressive pursuits of their own initiation. Instead, they would respond in double measure. Our code of honor does indeed restrain our valiant warriors from raising one arm against a person who's done us no harm. So therefore, the Western interpretation of the statement, the friend of my enemy is oversimplified. Only if your friendship is camouflaged alliance. True friends are believed to be able to counsel us when we do wrong. They are to sympathize with us when we lose our way, and to defend us when somebody wrongs us. Actors must work hard to prevent war by accident. That's the famous Arabic saying that says, most conflagrations start with little sparks. Avoid devastation and necessitated listening to cooler heads, holding one's tongue, exercising patience with the touch of magnanimity, and staying above petty insults. Your tongue is your horse. Protect it, and it will protect you. Hold your tongue, accepting four pursuits, clarifying right, combating a falsehood, acknowledging a favor, and exhibiting wisdom. And we have sayings in Arabic, before responding to aggressive words, be ready to do so before jumping in. The great Al-Mutanabi, who they call, unquote, the Shakespeare of Arabic literature, says, weapons are easy for all men to have, yet claws alone don't make a lion brave. Numerical superiority. The Prophet said, defending the Ummah with only a small number of followers, he drew inspiration from the Quran. How often have the few vanquished the many? By the will of who? Allah. Vitalistic leaders who try to whip up courage of their fighters do so usually succeed, as exemplified by the story of the nervous soldier. The sergeant came and said, don't be afraid, go fight. The only bullet that will kill you is the one that is meant for you. And the soldier turned to his side. He said, Sarge, I'm not worried about the bullet with my name on it. The one I'm afraid of is the one that says to whom it may concern. Arabs responded rather than initiate wars. Islam emphasized this. No compulsion religion. You have your religion and I have mine. And the whole lot. Omar ibn al-Khattab went to the sepulchre. He refused to pray there, afraid that was some the some Muslim would try to claim it. And lo and behold, he was right. Next where he prayed, there is a mosque. And to this day, many folks don't know this, the keys to the holy sepulchre is still kept by Muslim family, the Najashibis and the Nusaybis in Jerusalem. Hyperboles are plenty. And sometimes if you cannot defend yourself, be smart, like the small boy who was surprised by marauders and took the camels. He went and boasted, said, I powered them with my crosses so much that they ran away with the camels. And of course, Arabic annals are full of the bravest and eloquent poet, Antar. And talks about the prescription for success in battle. Hit the one that is never so hard that even the brave ones will take off flight. But here is Antar, a bull was chasing, and men were running after the bull to capture the bull. And Antar did what? He ran the hell away from the bull. So they said, the great Antar is running away from the bull. He said, look, the bull does not know I'm the champ. So this idea that Muslims have this culture of recklessness and all they do is begin wars is not in the evidence. And now that, let's move on faster because I only have 2 more minutes. We have the idea of human rights, determinants of Sharia, basic principle of political system. And in Islam, human rights, we talk about haq al-hayah, the right to live. American Constitution. Haq al-hurayah, the right to liberty. American Constitution. Haq al-kamaluk, the right to ownership. American Constitution. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of what? Happiness. So our Islam is not incompatible with American ideals. But we have even two more that is not in our Constitution. Haq al-karama, the right to dignity, and haq al-ilm, the right, even obligation of education. So therefore, in Islam, if we practice Islam to its right, many of you students don't have to take student loans. Why? Because once you owe that student loan, you better make sure you pay it. You see, Osama bin Laden may be foolish, but he's not stupid. When he was in the U.S., he never took a student loan. Had he taken a student loan, the loan folks would have found him right now. I know, I went to school with one of my friends. When he graduated, he got his good job in the Fiji Islands, in the remotest parts of the Fiji. And later on, he got a letter from the student loan people saying, in about a month, your loan payment will start to be due. So the friend wrote me a letter and said, how the hell did they know I'm in the Fiji? And I said, the CIA may not find you. The FBI may not find you. The IRS may not find you, but those student loan people will find you. So if Osama bin Laden had taken a student loan, he'll be in his cave right now. The terminals of Sharia, wajib, obligatory, mandub, the permissible, mubah, the indifferent, haram, the forbidden. Makruh, the repugnant. Political system, tawhid, which is the belief that Allah is the creator, sustainer, and master of everything that exists on earth. Risala, the media in which law of Allah is brought down to receive. Khalifa, representation, man is supposed to represent God on earth. And of course, we have democratic structure, the Amir, the Shura, and the Qadi to interpret Sharia. Of course, these are well written in Abul al-Hasan al-Muwardi's 9 principles of democracy. The aim of the Islamic State is to create a society as conceived in the Quran and Sunnah. The state shall enforce the Sharia as the fundamental law of the state. Sovereignty rests with the people. The people can plan and set up any form of conforming with the above two. Whatever the form of state must be based on the principles of popular representation. Again, Abu al-Hasan al-Mawardi, who of course you know who they quote. So again, the final word is that Islam is not a war of religion. Islam says you have the right to defend the Ummah when attacked. Let's be very clear, it's not a pacifistic religion. But once it teaches, do not begin trouble. Only when you have to defend the Ummah, you have to defend your family, you have to defend your life. Only then can you engage in wars. For 13 years, the first Muslims were persecuted. The Prophet was spat upon, was cursed, did nothing until the revelation came for him to defend Ummah. Even with that, there were a whole lot of restrictions. So therefore, Islam teaches patience. And I will close with a short story that will take 30 seconds. I'm the student advisor for the Muslim Student Association on the main campus at American University. And my students usually come complaining that sometimes they will be asleep and one set of homeland security folks, that's homeland security. We wake them up like 2 o'clock in the morning and ask them all sorts of questions. They go back to sleep 1 hour later, another group comes, ask the same questions to see if they are saying something different. This is happening regularly. So I say, what is the problem? I say, you are a Muslim, be patient. Even this shall pass. He said, well, Prof, that is not my problem. I said, what is your problem? I'm so depressed that I have to be on the telephone calling my folks back home, my friends, every day, just so that I can get my nerves, my senses back. Now my telephone bill is so big, I don't even know how to pay it. I said, don't pay the bill. He said, why not? I said, how long have your phone been going that they... it's still going on. He said, for months now, the bill keep piling. I say, if the phone company have not cut your telephone, it means somebody is listening. I say, so don't pay the bills. Whenever your phone bill is up to $1,000 and I haven't cut, you know somebody's listening. And then he said, but Prof, I'm a Muslim. I said, thank you very much.
Assalamu alaikum. I'd first like to express my thanks to the organizers of this conference, the Islamic Legal Forum, and in particular to Nayat Ahmed.
That mic.
And in particular, Junaid Ahmed, who persuaded me to come here. You still can't hear me? Oh, I thought I could extend this. Well, just be patient. I will gather steam, and I will raise my voice as I proceed. I must say, Professor Bangura will be a tough act to follow. I have just one PhD, which I acquired many years ago, and I'm not pursuing any decent one.
But it is you I cite all the time.
Economics. I will begin with a story. I never go anywhere to any talk without an inseparable friend, Mullah Nasruddin. Mm-hmm. I suppose some of you might know who he is. I don't know that there was really any person by the name of Mullah Nasruddin, but there are many stories containing profound wisdom, but also full of humor, wit, about human failings, about the failings of human perceptions. So Mullah Nasruddin once went to his neighbor, and who was known to be a mean sort of fellow. He went up to him and addressed him. He says, "Sir, your ox has gored my cow and killed her after she refused his amorous advances." His neighbor interrupted him, telling him, "So what has that got to do with me? Should a man be held responsible for what an animal does?" The mullah answered cheekily, "Thank you, sir. It was my ox that gored your cow." I will let you work out the connections between this story and what I'm going to talk about. I'm essentially going to talk about terrorism, the rhetoric that United States and before that Israel was using to suppress resistance. We all know that immediately after 9/11, United States declared a war on global terrorism. In fact, there is one particular statement that I want to quote from President Bush that he made on September 21st, 2001. And he said, "Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have seen. It may include dramatic strikes seen on TV and covert operations, secret even in success." So what United States is announcing now is a plan to engage in endless war, unlimited war, a war that can emerge in any corner of the world. And they call this the global war on terrorism, or the war on global terrorism. Is that really what they mean? Are they speaking of terrorism per se, or is it terrorism of a particular kind? What I first want to do is examine how this particular notion of terrorism being the greatest menace to mankind, to civilization, to liberty, and to United States, how it has entered into public discourse. And thankfully, Google offered me the tool to investigate this in a very rough and ready manner. And what I did was to Google certain terms, certain exact phrases. Even before that, I just Googled the term terrorism. And I found that there were 106 million hits that come up associated just with the word terrorism. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that doesn't say a great deal unless I compare it to some other key terms that have been popular in Western discourse for many years, one of which is communism, and I found only 16 million hits for communism, as compared to 106 million hits for terrorism, 72 million additional hits for terror, and another 58 million hits for terrorists. These are separate, and if you add them all together, they add up to some 230 million hits. If you Google the word democracy, which one would think would be all-pervasive, since that is the image we want to present to the world, democracy comes up with a hit of 97 million, and so on and so forth. So you can see how so quickly, within a few years, the term terrorist, terrorism, and terror has pervaded, has become the overwhelming language in which the Western world, in which the great powers justify what they want to do. Then I Googled certain exact phrases, you know, phrases where terrorism and terror and terrorists come with the word Islam or Islamic. And I found altogether about 5 million hits with these exact phrases. Of course, again, what does that mean? Is that too many or too few? Well, in order to put it in perspective, I also Google for exact phrases where the word terror, terrorism, and terrorists come with the word, let's say, Hindu. And I got only 13,000 hits for that. 13,000. And then I Googled with these terms with the word Jewish, and they came up about 118,000 times. And then I Googled the word Tamil, whom we know have been very major, have engaged in major acts of quote-unquote terrorism, and that came up only about 20,000 times. So you can see that if you look at the universe of words where terrorism is associated with a particular people or a particular civilization, Islam is receiving the lion's share of attention. And therefore, that in itself suggests that, you know, when the press, the media, and the politicians speak of global terrorism, what they really mean is Islamic terrorism. Then one comes across a question: how can one wage war against terrorism? Terrorism is a tactic; it is not an ideology. It is not a goal. It is only a means. So how can you wage war against terrorism? And this is a question that should really baffle a lot of people, but there are not too many people that are disconcerted by this notion of waging war against a tactic. But I will argue that, in fact, this is a very clever, a very cunning, and a very effective way of achieving the objectives that United States and Israel before that have set out to achieve. You know, especially after the end of the Cold War, we know that United States became, you know, the uncontested power in the world. And United States had the military and the overwhelming military and economic and political capability to seek to dominate the world in a way that it had not dominated before. It was a temptation. Now, to seek to dominate the world militarily, to seek to entrench American dominance in a manner that it would become irreversible. That was the project of the new century. We know that that is a neo a neocon project led mostly by American liquidniks. Now, the question before the United States was, this was the goal, to create, to entrench American power so that it becomes irreversible. And terrorism offered a very powerful tool. See? It was the right tool because it created fear, fear in the American public. And this fear could then be used to abridge rights within the United States so that no one within this quasi-democracy, which is exactly what it is, within this quasi-democracy will be able to resist this war. And they have abridged rights. You know, within a week of 9/11, they promulgated the quote-unquote Patriotic Act, which contained the seeds of a fascist state. And they have gone on and made torture legal. They have gone on and made indefinite incarceration illegal. They have gone on and made kidnapping illegal. All these actions have also been taken against American citizens. In addition, once this fear that terrorism inspires is magnified by the media by constantly harping on the notion that we face this enormous menace, then in fact you also are able to persuade people to give you the right to engage in preemptive wars. And that is what the Congress did within a few weeks. The Congress gave the US government the right to wage unlimited war. So that if the United States today wants to attack Iran, it really doesn't have to go to the Congress. And then it has a second advantage, the notion of war against global terrorism. Terrorists, we know, are elusive. They don't have an address. When they engage in acts of terror, they don't leave a return address where you can find them. And this gives us the justification for making our war global, because we don't know where they are, therefore we must have the right. So we are justified in waging war wherever we want to. And so this gives the license to make the war global, okay? And to strike anywhere. And the United States has struck in many places, wherever it has felt even the weakest justification to do so. We know just a few weeks back, the United States bombed Somalia. Before that, the United States bombed a group of people in Yemen. And then the United States has bombed several times targets in Pakistan. The United States has bombed targets or participated in actions against Muslims in
Philippines.
In the Philippines. Mm. And not to speak of the war against Iraq and Afghanistan, and now it is you know priming itself for a war against Iran. One then asks the question: Why hasn't the U.S. government come out openly and said this is a war against Muslims? When in fact most people in the Muslim world recognize that they are, in fact, the primary, if not the exclusive, targets of this war. Well, that wouldn't be political. That wouldn't be advisable. You know, people in this country perfectly well understand, you see, who the targets are. They know that it's not the Chinese, it's not the Indians, it's not the Latin Americans. They know who the targets are. And therefore, one does not have to come out in the open and identify the targets, because in doing so, they create problems in the Islamic world. Because we have some very powerful allies in the Islamic world. Right? Who are they? Virtually every one of the single states in the Islamic world are our allies. Our allies in the war against global terrorism. And so if the United States came out openly and said, Muslims are our targets, then in fact these states, these allies, these surrogates that we have in the Islamic world would be under somewhat greater pressure. Okay, so the objective of this war is to use these good Muslims, Husni Mubaraks and Musharrafs, to wage war against the Muslims. Okay, and then most importantly, this global war against terrorism in its ultimate intention is to delegitimize resistance, legitimate resistance, nationalist resistance, resistance against imperialism, resistance against invasion, resistance against bombing, resistance against oppression, resistance against any form of colonial domination. That is the ultimate goal of this global war on terrorism. And this is achieved very cleverly in two stages. First, and I will talk somewhat about this, at some length about this. First, we delegitimize the use of violence as a means of resistance. You simply can't use violence as a means of resistance. That's the first thing. And we do it by equating violence with terror. Violent resistance is terrorism. That is something that we have learned from Israel, which Israel did very effectively. It succeeded in persuading the Western world, much of the Western world, that these Palestinians are nothing but terrorists. They do not have a legitimate cause. They do not have a cause that justifies their engaging in resistance of any form, and not to speak of violent resistance. And so the first clever move is to equate all forms of violence with terrorism. And then you take the next step, that anyone who supports violent resistance, i.e. terrorism, is rendering material assistance to terrorists, and that then covers almost everyone. Anyone who supports resistance, anyone who provides any kind of material, moral, political support to any resistance is also a terrorist. So that virtually is a blanket. It delegitimizes all forms of resistance, not just violent resistance, because violent resistance is terrorism. But if you support resistance or violent resistance in any form, shape, then you are providing material assistance to terrorists, and therefore you are a terrorist. And we know that many people in this country, many Muslims, have been arrested, have been incarcerated, because they have provided assistance to Palestinians, financial assistance to Palestinians, or moral assistance to Palestinians. So in fact, United States now has the license, one, to wage war and to bomb, to strike, to engage in preemptive wars. In addition, it has also given itself the right to target individuals. And so the terror that this has created is truly global. Instead of waging war against global terrorism, actually, you know, we are using the tools of global terrorism. Now I'd like to stand back from all of this and really, you know, examine how, for instance, United States has used the term terrorist, how it defines the term terrorist in order to delegitimize resistance. There are three definitions that you can come across. One is offered by the FBI, the other by the Department of Defense, and then the Department of State. I'm not going to go into the individual definitions. You can check them out on the web, because I don't have the time to do so. But if you examine these definitions collectively, then this is what you find. That according to these definitions, and they are not identical, first of all, the terrorists are state or non-state actors. Incidentally, they do not exclude state from their purview of terrorism. So they are not state or non-state actors who engage in or threaten violent actions that produce harm to property or persons for political ends. So there are four ingredients in this definition, in their comprehensive composite definition of terrorism. One is that it involves agents who may be state or non-state actors. They employ violent means or the threat of violence, and these violent means result in harm to persons or property, and their goals are political, any political goals. Okay? So fundamentally, any person who engages in violence for a political end, even a legitimate political end, where the end is resistance, it's a national liberation movement, resisting occupation, that becomes terrorism by this definition. And in fact, there are some very strange conclusions that you can draw from. It's so easy to establish that even some relatively harmless act, such as the Boston Tea Party, can be classified according to this definition as a terrorist act. It is a terrorist act because it destroyed property, And the definition of terrorism that the U.S. offers officially says, if you destroy persons or property. So it destroyed property, and its intention was to intimidate, its intention was political, to intimidate or coerce the British government. So the Boston Tea Party, according to this definition, is an act of terrorism. We all know that it was not an act, it was an act of resistance. It was the first act of resistance mounted by the Americans against British colonialism. So the fundamental, of course, governments are not particularly disturbed by anomalies or contradictions in their positions, because those contradictions will not be the focus of discussions. So what we find from here, that the objective is to seek to delegitimize all forms of violence, in the service of any political goal that is hostile to American interests. You know, again, we need to step further back and ask how terrible is terrorism. You know, how great a menace, how serious a menace is it? Is terrorism, does it constitute a particularly odious form of violence? And does it account for a significant or a large or overwhelming share of violent deaths that we see around the world? And I will end this talk by referring to some statistics. In political discourse, you know, if you look at the definition of violence, you will see that that definition itself is biased to favor certain parties, to favor the strong parties. Violence is always defined in terms of two ingredients, the employment or the use of violent means, and then the second ingredient is the violent effect of these violent means. And then thirdly, there has to be a direct connection between the violent means and the violent ends. So violence is restricted. Violence requires that the means you employ is also violent. Now what this does is to tremendously narrow the actual scope of violence that you can condemn, that you can denounce, that you can use as a pretext for engaging in acts of war or in acts of resistance. Let me counter this by giving you an example. Let's suppose the IMF goes into the country of Niger and tells the government of Niger that if you want your loans to be rescheduled, you have to privatize the distribution of water. Currently, it is a state enterprise, and the state enterprise provides water at, let's say, subsidized rates or provides it free to whoever lives in the cities, especially. So the IMF goes in and tells these people that you have to privatize water. It is privatized, it is sold to a French corporation. And the French corporation then charges the market rate, or probably a monopoly market price for this water. And this means that tens of thousands of people who had previously access to clean drinking water now have to do without it. They now drink contaminated water, they become sick, and they die. And tens of thousands of people die because water has been privatized. So the IMF Act was to persuade, to pressure the government not to privatize water. Privatizing water, you might say, is simply a change in economic policy. It is not a violent act, right, by any definition, so it is not the employment of violent means. Nevertheless, it has resulted in tens of thousands, perhaps millions of deaths over a year. Hundreds of thousands of children will die of diarrhea, of cholera, of malaria, and many other diseases. And this is a connection that you can establish without any doubt. You know, we know that if you disconnect the availability of free water or cheaper water, there will be poor people will be without it. They will drink contaminated water, and contaminated water will cause diseases and deaths. So there is an indubitable connection between this change in policy, which is a nonviolent act. But should we therefore ignore this? Should we therefore not pay any attention to this? Should we not be concerned about this as much as bombing? A bomb, even a A 14,000, a 22,000 bomb will kill maybe 100 people, 200 people. But here is an action of IMF, which is killing globally, because this is UN, IMF policy, millions of people across the globe. Okay? Should we not pay much greater, infinitely greater attention to this act of violence that emanates from IMF? Or should we worry about the few bombs that go around here and there and kill at the most a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people? So the whole discourse of violence is hijacked, is distorted in a manner so that we fail to recognize the truly horrendous acts of violence with which we have to live. And therefore we need to define, redefine violence. We need to redefine violence to include all acts, all processes, all structures that produce violent outcomes. Okay? Not simply reduce it to violent means which produce violent outcomes. Frequently, violent means may not even produce violent outcomes. And now let me give you some statistics on how grave a threat, and massive a threat terrorism is. The deadliest act of terrorism that we know about occurred in 9/11, and that killed 2,752 people. Of course, we mourn those people. I can wish deeply with all my heart that that had not occurred. But yet, when you place it in context, where millions of people die because of the violent processes and structures that are embedded in the global capitalist system, what should we worry about? What should command our attention? What should command our outrages? Those few acts of violence, even though they are egregious? Or should we worry about those things that are the structures that perpetrate violence, that cause deaths, that cause diseases? You know, let me also give you the total yearly deaths from terrorism. In 2001, there were 5,800 deaths from terrorism. That was the year of 9/11. In 2002, it went down to 3,000 deaths. In 2003, it was 4,300. Is this what should dominate our headlines, our evening news, our discussions? Is this really what we should be paying attention to? So we can very clearly see, of course, acts of terrorism, yes, they are dramatic, they have a terrifying impact, and the terror of these terrorist acts is magnified a thousandfold by the media, by the political system. But how many times are we going to hear about the million children who will die every year from diarrhea? The tens of millions whose lives will be shortened because they have to live in poverty that is created by the structures of capitalism, the structures of inequality, the structures of global domination. Let me now give you some statistics on what is the scale of violence, scale of death and destruction that is caused by these structures. In 2003, the population of sub-Saharan Africa was about 703 million. And their life expectancy at birth was 46 years. In the developed countries, the high-income countries, with a population of close to a billion, the life expectancy was 78 years. So this, you know, the life expectancy in developed countries tells us that with greater equality, not necessarily the high per capita income, because in some poor countries, we are able to raise life expectancy to 72, 73, 75. See? So if you look at this disparity in life expectancy of the poor countries, poor sub-Saharan Africa, and the developed countries, what we see is the number of years of human life which are being destroyed by the system of inequality that has been historically created, and of which Africa, in particular, is the chief victim. Right? And how many million billion years are destroyed by this system, by this global system, which perpetrates and perpetuates this kind of inequality? 22.5 billion years of human life are destroyed in Africa. You know, we could probably at one-tenth the cost of the war that we are waging in against the Iraqis, bring about changes in Africa which would raise their life expectancy within a few years to 7 years from 46. And then let's look at another thing, just you know, tobacco use. Tobacco use kills 400,000 people in the United States alone every year, 1 out of 5. And many of these deaths could be avoided. And here you might say that people who smoke do it voluntarily, no one is forcing them. Yet we also know that tobacco causes deaths. Tobacco causes cancer. The connection between that is very well established. Now, many of these deaths could be avoided if we, let's say, imposed a ban on cigarette advertising, all forms of cigarette advertising, not only on TV, on radios. And we had better funded programs for creating a public awareness of the connection between cigarette smoking and cancer and deaths. We don't do that. If we did that, what is the system that prevents us from doing that? We know that it is mostly the power of the cigarette corporations, the tobacco corporations. The tobacco corporations will have powerful lobbying wings, employ the best lawyers in this country to lobby. They probably most likely make tremendous contributions to the election and re-election of senators and congressmen and presidents. And so it is the power, the entrenched interests of a particular set of corporations which prevents us from acting more vigorously to prevent the deaths from tobacco. One can, you know, if one wants to find out all the deaths that could be prevented if we change, in many cases only marginally, the structures, the acts, the processes which inform the global capitalist system which create inequalities, then that is what we should be talking about. Unfortunately, not only does the media not talk about it, even the social sciences don't talk about it, because the social sciences too are a part of the same establishment. And to call them social sciences itself is a misnomer. They are not. Okay. Well, my time is up, so I will end. I actually wanted to end very briefly with by talking about you know, why do Muslims engage in acts of terror? But if you will give me the permission later on, I might probably speak on that in answer to some questions. Thank you very much.
Assalamualaikum, can you hear me? Okay. I'm here actually to substitute for Dr. Hamid Dabashi, who was supposed to be on the panel, but he, I guess, unfortunately became ill, and so Junaid asked me if I would step in at the last minute to substitute for him. So please forgive the informal nature of these comments. What I thought I would do is try to talk about the kind of resources, spiritual, theological, and legal resources that Muslims bring to the question of citizenship in a liberal democracy. And what I want to talk about is, one, you know, that, you know, the problem of liberal citizenship is a problem that arises in the modern era as a consequence of, you know, this new idea of the nation state and with the subject of the citizen. And so it's an interesting problem in the history of political philosophy, and so Muslims shouldn't be surprised if they don't find a clear-cut answer sort of in their tradition about what it means to be a citizen. Nevertheless, I do think, you know, we have resources that we can bring to the table and give us a good normative grounding for citizenship in liberal democracies. Now I want to start off with what I think is a very interesting observation by an Indian politician that he made around the time of partition. His name is Humayun Kabir, in which he made the following observation about pre-Islamic political thought, in which he said that, you know, when you read the scholars of Islam and their writings on politics, they generally assume two situations for Muslims. Either they lived in a state in which they were the rulers, and so there wasn't a problem. They would just live according to what they believed was proper. Or they were dominated by non-Muslims, in which case the question became, you know, to what extent can we live here, or should we do hijra, or exit, go to another place? But he observed that a modern liberal secular state is a different situation. And then let me quote. He said, "But Muslim political thought had not provided for the situation which has developed in India today, the situation in which Muslims are citizens in a secular state. In this situation, they are neither the sole rulers nor merely the ruled. We can put it in another way and say that they are the rulers and the ruled simultaneously. As a citizen of India, he is subject to the laws of the state, like any other citizen professing any religion. In a democratic state, every citizen has a share in sovereignty, and therefore we have in India today this unique situation, a situation which has never before faced Muslim people anywhere in the world. They are not merely ruled, but neither are they merely rulers. They are rulers and ruled at the same time. Further, they are not rulers by themselves. They are rulers in association with people of many different religions." So that's essentially, I think, a very pithy statement of the challenges of being a modern citizen, Muslim citizen, in a secular democratic state. So how do we think about this challenge that Humayun Kabir identified from sort of a theological and ethical perspective in Islam? Well, the first thing I think we have to do is try to understand what, you know, some basic distinctions, I think, between citizenship and being a believer. So in my view, it's important to understand that a liberal state is based on a notion that the competence of public authority is limited to a relatively narrow set of concerns, sort of our secular well-being, right? Whereas being a believer, being a servant of God, obudiyya, is comprehensive, because we believe that while the state may only be accountable to the state for a certain set of our actions, God holds us accountable to everything that we do, even our thoughts. So there's a disconnect between citizenship and our status as a servant of God, because the latter is broad and comprehensive, whereas our status as citizen is much more narrow. And so the question is there any overlap between the two in a way that's morally significant? And I think here, I think, is the way to think about this problem. And so I want to start with a verse in the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لَا خَيْرَ فِي كَثِيرٍ مِنْ نَجْوَاهُمْ إِلَّا مَنْ أَمَرَ بِصَدَقَةٍ أَوْ مَعْرُوفٍ أَوْ إِصْلَاحٍ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ وَمَنْ يَفْعَلْ ذَلِكَ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ فَسَوْفَ نُؤْتِيهِ أَجْرًا عَظِيمًا. Which means, no good is there in much of their conversation, save for those who command to charity or customary good deeds or reconciliation among people. And whosoever does these things, desiring thereby the pleasure of God, certainly we shall give him a great reward. Now, one of the medieval scholars, Ibn Rajab al-Hanbali, commented on this verse, saying that this verse on its face does two things, right? It affirms the good of the secular world regardless of religious intentions, because it says that there is no good in much of what they say except for those who do those things, right? So it affirms that those who do these things, namely commanding to charity, commanding toward what's customarily considered good, and commanding toward reconciliation among people, all of that qualifies as good. So these are all secular temporal goods that the Quran affirms according to Ibn Rajab. It then affirms a second truth, and it says, even though these are good in the secular life, it only counts, so to speak, for God in the next life if you do it with the intention of pleasing God. Right? So because that's how the verse concludes, وَمَنْ يَفْعَلْ ذَلِكَ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ فَسَوْفَ نُؤْتِيهِ أَجْرًا عَظِيمًا. So the conclusion of the verse is, whoever does these things, we will give them a reward if they do it for the sake of God. Right? But those who don't do it for the sake of God, they're still doing something good. Right? They're not doing something evil. They're doing something good. It's just that good is limited to the secular world. This, I think, gives us a good sort of insight or a good sort of entry point to discuss sort of the relationship in Islamic theology between the good order of this world, right, and our spiritual aims as believers. And I think Imam Ghazali, radiallahu anhu, has very insightful discussions of these issues. So I want to talk a little bit about what he says. So in his masterpiece at Ihya Ulum al-Din, the Revival of Religious Sciences, in Kitab al-Ilm, the very first book, the Book of Knowledge, Ghazali does what sort of good medieval philosophers do. He gives a taxonomy of all the sciences, the secular sciences and the religious sciences and the rational sciences and the positive sciences. And he comes to the question of jurisprudence, fiqh, and what is the status of fiqh. And interestingly, he denies that fiqh, as conventionally known, is a religious science. Instead, he says it's a profane science. It's a worldly science because it's concerned with the organization of the world, right? And that the authority of the jurist, the faqih, is limited to this world. And for Ghazali, we know that the good order of this world, in a secular sense, meaning a society that we can sort of recognize as being somewhat just, right, is a logically and sociologically prior to the good order of religion. So if you look at one of his theological works, Al-Iqtisad al-I'tiqad, in his proof of the imamate, he argues that the organization of the world, husn al-nizam al-dunya, right, is a condition precedent for the good order of religion. It's shart l'husn al-nizam al-din, right? So you can't imagine, according to Ghazali, that religion can exist in a world dominated by sort of, you know, Hobbesian chaos and a Hobbesian state of nature, right, where everyone, using his images, is too busy fighting off oppressors with their swords to go out and earn their daily bread and go to the mosque and pray and learn what God wants of them, right? So Ghazali in the Ahya mentions, when he begins to discuss politics and placing it in the various among the various ranks of worldly crafts, he classifies politics, the siyasa, as the highest, as the noblest secular craft, above any of the other secular pursuits that one can follow, because he says its purpose is, quote, to create harmony, society, and cooperation towards achieving the means of social life as well as their organization. لِتَأْلِيفِ وَالِاجْتِمَاعِ وَالتَّعَاوُنْ عَلَى أَسْبَابِ الْمَعِيشَ وَضَبْطِهَا. That's the purpose of politics. And that's the highest secular craft that anyone can do. Because without these things, it's impossible to live your life in a way that's pleasing to God. Okay? And so Ghazali then proceeds to discuss four different kinds of politics. He mentions the highest kind of politics is prophetic politics, the politics practiced by the prophets. And it's the highest kind of politics because prophets not only teach us about our secular interests, but they also teach us about our higher aims in the next life. And so they address our interior beings, our interior life, as well as our exterior life. So therefore, it's the highest type of politics. Next comes secular politics. He talks about caliphs, kings, and sultans. You know, those are the rulers that he was talking about, but we can just describe them generally as secular politics. And secular politics is limited to, well, it extends to all of us. Everyone is living under the rule of some secular jurisdiction. But it's deficient in that secular politics has no jurisdiction over our inward lives. It doesn't address our conscience, right? It doesn't address our dhimma, right? Or who we are as moral beings. All it does is it addresses our external conduct, right? Because that's the jurisdiction of government, to tell us what to do here, not to do that, to make sure that the means of life are well organized, as Ghazali talks earlier about. Then there's the politics of the scholars, here, the ulama. Here, what they do is they are inheriting the message, the moral message of the prophets, right? And their sultan, their wilaya, right, is limited to the inward lives of human beings, in that they teach them what the prophets taught them, right? And they address the minds of human beings and giving them a conception of the good and how to live it and what they need to do in order to attain, salvation in the next life. Now, the last category is sort of a residual one, which is a reflection, I think, of the elitism of the Middle Ages, and hopefully we can sort of get beyond that. But the last category was the jurisdiction of the preacher. The preacher is the person who addresses sort of the uneducated, who are unable to understand the proofs and the reasoning of the ulama, of the true ulama. You know, it's my hope that in the modern age, everyone becomes an educated person and can understand rationally instead of just being subject to preaching. But the point that Ghazali is making is that we have to understand our lives. We have a secular life that's governed by politics, and we have our interior life, our moral life, that's governed by religion, and we have two different groups of people who are doing both. And how does fiqh tie into this? Well, most people will ask, well, fiqh is religion. Of course, it's a matter of fact the best, the highest religious science, and they'll cite the hadith, man arada bi khayran yufaqihu fi din, right? And he says, well, that's true, but that's not the fiqh that we're talking about. That's the old fiqh, which was talking about real spirituality and things like that. That's not the way that people use fiqh today. Sort of like what I was talking about yesterday, what you find in law books. That's what he's talking about. He says that's a profane science. And why is it? It's because, again, it's like for Ghazali, he says, they're like, the fuqaha are like the guards of a caravan. If you can imagine yourself living 500 years ago and going to Hajj, it's not like today you hop on a plane in JFK and you land in Jeddah and there are people there to pick up your bags, put you on a bus, and you go. That's not how it was. You got in a caravan, you went through deserts, and it was quite a dangerous journey. And at times, you could be subject to attack by bandits. So the fuqaha, according to Ghazali, are like the guards that would be assigned to protect pilgrims, the caravans of pilgrims, right? Absolutely necessary. There's no way you could go on pilgrimage unless you had the guards, because if you didn't have the guards, bandits would kill you. So you got to have them. But they're not they're not desired in and of themselves. It's not a noble profession. It's not commanded in of itself to be a guard of the pilgrimage. It's rather, it's obligatory in the way that certain means become obligatory, but it's not obligatory in the sense that it's an end in and of itself. So that's the same thing with the rules of the fuqaha. It's not something that is desired in and of itself. Rather, they're obligatory to the extent that they help achieve this husn al-nidham, right, to organize our society, to allow us to do our other religious obligations and prepare for the next world. Interestingly, Ghazali tells us that worldly sciences such as jurisprudence, such as fiqh, right, can be discharged equally well by religious people and non-religious people, because to be a competent jurist doesn't require the kind of doesn't require the inner component of prophecy, right? Just like medicine. You can be a competent doctor or a competent engineer without any type of spiritual motivations. And he tells us that, for example, Umar ibn al-Khattab, he's famous for his justice in the Islamic tradition. And he says it's conceivable that somebody could be just as just as Umar ibn al-Khattab without having the true religious knowledge that Umar ibn al-Khattab had. Right, so the two aren't necessarily connected. You could be just from the perspective of secular life, right? But you don't have to have religious motivations. In other words, religious motivations are not a necessary condition to act justly in the secular world, according to Ghazali. However, interestingly, he says justice is necessary to live a religious life. Okay, so he says, من حصل الحديث والعلم ثم تصوف أفلح ومن تصوف قبل العلم خاطر بنفسه. Whosoever studies the traditions of the Prophet and obtains knowledge, religious knowledge, then becomes a mystic, then devotes themselves to the interior path, right, succeeds. But whosoever devotes himself to the inner life before obtaining this religious knowledge risks his soul. We have a similar saying attributed to Imam Malik radiallahu anhu, who is reported to have said, "من تصوف من غير أن يتفقى تزندق ومن تصوف ومن ومن تفقى من غير أن يتصوف تفسق." So Imam Malik is reported to have said, "Whosoever becomes a Sufi or becomes devoted to the mystic path without learning the law becomes a heretic. But whosoever studies law without Sufism becomes dissolute, morally dissolute." Right? So we need to have both. Right? We need to have both. And I think that's the basic insight here, or at least the potentiality that liberal politics and liberal citizenship affords Muslims, by because liberal politics and liberal citizenship understands this distinction, right, between the limited jurisdiction of a state, right, to our conduct, right, and the independence of our inner lives and the necessity of cultivating our inner lives. This in and of itself, I think, is very consistent with traditional Muslim moral theology and traditional Muslim political theory. So I think it's a very important point that we have to bring to public discourse when talking about issues like equality and Muslim commitments to human rights and Muslim commitments to peace, is not just to say that, well, we're against terrorism, we're against war, et cetera, et cetera. We also need to be able to show the kind of resources that we bring, right, that show our moral commitment to these ideas and what we have to bring to the table. So I just wanted to give a very brief introduction to some of these concepts, and hopefully if there are questions, we can talk about them later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was my unpleasant duty to remind the speakers. I didn't mean to cut them off, especially Dr. Muhammad Fadl, who was on a very important point. There will be question and answer. We have about 15 minutes, and we want to finish it exactly at 1 o'clock so that we fulfill some obligations of physical nourishment also. There will be lunch ready outside this room. We'll adjourn exactly at 1 o'clock. And there's a prayer area available in room 608. Please follow the signs. And we'll reconvene at 2 p.m. for Islam and gender politics here in this hall. So if you have any questions, please line up there near the microphone. And I will request the speakers to be very short in their brief in their answers so that we can have opportunity available to many comments and questions. Please identify yourself and also address the question to any.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Zainab Chima. First of all, I just wanted to thank all the speakers for their eloquent presentations. I specifically wanted to address Professor Alam's wonderful discourse of the terrorist, you know, phenomenon in the post 9/11 world, and his, you know, setting it up in context. Well, just to give a comment, I guess the prequel to the events that you describe in your speech are the National Security Acts of 1945 and 1946 that allowed the military, you know, apparatus set up to wage World War II to keep the United States in a constant state of war to, you know, combat the quote-unquote communist threat. So I guess in a very real sense, we've been in a state of war since 1945. And now, in the post 9/11 world, the phenomenon has sort of become global. And, you know, as you noted in your speech, it's sort of become, you know, not only for state actors, but also for non-state actors. Well, I guess my question specifically that I wanted to ask you was, what are your sort of recommendations for resources or strategies that Muslims in America today can sort of take upon to, you know, combat or to sort of engage with the terrorist discourse that we sort of are confronted with on a daily basis in the social space? And a sort of side question is there a website where you post your articles on a daily basis or as soon as you are able to write them? Thank you.
Well, let me first address your last question because that is very easy to answer. I had a website, when I was subjected to massive attacks from people who were reading things on that website, I decided to take it down temporarily. But it will be up again, and it's called aslama.net.
And what's the spelling for Aslama?
A-S-L-A-M-A. My original website was stolen by someone else. What can we do? What do we need to do? You know, my deepest grievances is not against the West. My deepest grievances are against Muslims for our failings, for our inactivity, and most fundamentally for our failure to engage ourselves intellectually with the problems that we confront. I think the poverty of intellect amongst Muslims today is alarming, and it has become worse over the last 50 years since the post-war period, during which we have seen an enormous increase in our resources. Yet we have, you know, although we have acquired human capital, that human capital is so narrowly defined, it only permits us to do jobs, secure, well-paying jobs. The best Muslim minds do not enter into the field of scholarship because it is not monetarily attractive. So if a society relinquishes the demands upon that are placed upon it to think seriously, think deeply, even at some small sacrifice to them, to their financial position, then that is a society without a shield. Ultimately, your scholars, as Professor Fadl was saying, that the ulama, the fuqaha, are the guards. I think scholarship is the shield that protects the Muslims, and Muslims today are without a shield.
Could I just clarify my question?
Yes.
I completely identify with what you just said.
Yes.
Because I'm a Muslim woman, and I made the decision to go into English literature and political science for my
career. Alhamdulillah.
And I had to fight an uphill battle with all the aunties and uncles who were like, oh, you're not in medicine, or you're not in computer science or engineering. It was very strange for them to accept the idea that I wouldn't be going in a track that would be immediately professional. The problem that I'm confronting as a Muslim here is that what you did in your 20-minute speech, which is first set up the context for the ideas, which is like the deconstructive context, redefine the terms, and then sort of, you know, criticize the status quo and the way of perceiving things. In sort of like your daily interactions, when people ask you incredibly ignorant questions that are, you know, not attuned to the proper context, it's really hard for me to engage with them because I can't sit down with them and sort of really explain to them and give them all this background in history. So I guess I'm not even sure if you can give me any tips on how to like quickly engage them. Perhaps you might recommend some books or some resources that people like me could use to sort of really.
That's a very good question. I don't think it takes a great deal to debunk many of the arguments that have been circulated in the public discourse. One of the fundamental premises after 9/11 was that they did it because they hate us. They did it because they hate our freedoms. Now, I think it takes just a few minutes, maybe a couple of minutes, to point out that to ask, why is it that these Muslims are targeting only United States if they hate our freedoms? There are many other countries in the world that are free. But if you look at the whole history of terrorist acts, they are centered almost exclusively until recently on United States. You know, if Britain and Spain have been attacked more recently, that is because they participated in the war against Iraq. You see? So we need scholars who will be able to tell you what arguments that you need to counter. And, you know, I don't want to be too terribly self-focused, but I'm an economist. And 9/11 forced me, when I, you know, to enter into the public discourse on Islam, on Islamic civilization, on politics. And essentially, I've been writing political essays, and I felt uneasy about it because I was not trained to engage in this kind of discourse. And yet I was forced into it because although there are probably 1,000 scholars, academics, Muslims, Arabs, Indians, Pakistanis in American universities, they write very fine articles for scholarly publications, yet they do not enter in, very few of them enter into public discourse. And in some cases, when they are even willing to, they are not allowed to enter into the mainstream discourse. But then we do publish on the internet. And I have brought together some of my essays in the form of the book that Professor Mumtaz Ahmed spoke about.
Thank you. Earlier, I requested the panelists to be very brief in their answers. I forgot to request the brothers and sisters who are to ask questions kindly to be brief in asking the questions as well and in their comments.
I'll be very brief. I don't know if you can hear me.
Sure. Yes,
my name is Salim Miqdadi. I might sound a helpless optimist, but this question is for all the panelists. About 700 years ago, Baghdad was burning, and the Mongols came to the Mesopotamia and burning Baghdad to the ground, and then later found out that they've got at their hands a beautiful faith, which they have embraced, and took with them to Central Asia. My question to you is, Baghdad is burning again today, and I want to see what is your perspective going, looking into the future of us as Muslims being exposed, or our faith is being exposed to the West, and by acts of terrorism, acts of war, and how the West can embrace this faith and nurture it and probably become leaders to this faith while still the Middle East is swimming in decadence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So why don't we begin with the Professor Fadal and then Professor Shahid Alam and then Professor Mangora. 90 seconds for 700 years history. Please.
There's some sort of saying that, you know, it's very hard to predict the future because nobody knows what will happen. I don't like to sort of predict things except to say that, you know, I can speak about my 30 years living in North America, or more than 30 years, right, and how much things have changed for the better despite everything, right? And what's and I think part of this is just simply that Muslims are generally really good people because Islam is good, and you can spend a lot of time trying to spread hate and misinformation about Islam, but nothing does better to dissipate it than people's interactions with Muslims, and that's happening more and more, and I think over time that's going to have a very, very positive effect, not just for Muslims in North America, but, you know, everywhere in the world, inshallah.
Inshallah.
One thing we have to make very clear is the question he began, he stated his optimism, and I share that optimism. One thing 9/11 did was provoke or encourage more interfaith dialogue, not only in the U.S., but all over the world. And the fact that Islam is the fastest growing religion in this country, and now we have more white males and more Latin, 5 out of every 7 Latino males that come to the United States convert to Islam. tells me that in this bleak environment, especially Puerto Ricans, tells me in this bleak environment there's something positive that is coming out of a tragedy. My optimism I share with you is that we have to be very clear. The United States is not anti-Islam. A survey we did, national survey we did just after 9/11, we have 40% of the respondents against 39 that we are unfavorable to Islam. Right after the bombing in Britain, we were thinking that the anti-Islam sentiment would have been even increased tremendously. It did not. Instead, what happened, the favorable image of Islam rose by 1% to 51%, and the negative declined. And those who were undecided, we are right in the middle. Our problem is not the average American. Our problem has always been the corporate media. And what we need to do is to challenge the corporate media to be a little more forthcoming. If we give the basic teachings, we Muslims live the way we are taught to live our lives, people in the world will accept what we have to bring to the plate. The story of the Muslim, of the first Gulf War, when the soldiers were sent, they got Islam 101 from only one imam in Kuwait. By the time he finishes lecture, you all know the story. Many of those troops converted to Islam because they finally found something they'll be yearning for. So again, truth and honesty and teaching the right creeds and living the life the way the Prophet taught us to live is the solution. And the media, we have to challenge, we have to find alternative media to make sure the good message is out. So I share your optimism 100%.
I have to, when there is so much optimism around, I have to take a contrarian position.
Okay.
You know, where I begin from is the following observation. See, it's true that, you know, after 1800, the West was ascendant. The West established its industrial military power and destroyed, dominated, or colonized all the other civilizations in the world. See? However, most of these other major civilizations, such as the Indian and the Chinese, have reconstituted themselves. And in fact, they are now ascendant. The only major civilization, in fact, the most a civilization that was ascendant for 1,000 years, i.e. Islam, has failed to reconstitute itself. And, you know, this is one reason for this is that we are close to Europe and therefore easy targets. Secondly, Europe wants to target us because of historical reasons. And whenever the Muslim world has tried to reconstitute itself, has made a beginning, as Muhammad Ali Pasha in the 19th century, Egypt again in the late 19th century, the Arab nationalist movement, Pakistan, they have been dismantled, they have been weakened, they have been overwhelmed, they have been defeated. And just right now, see, Iran is now the standard bearer, if you might say so. And Iran will be targeted. There is absolutely no question in my mind. And after that, Pakistan, if they succeed in doing, in targeting Iran. So what we really have to think deeply is how do we organize ourselves so that we can build strength to the point that we can resist without and not taking measures, not revealing our strength, not revealing our hand before the West comes and destroys us. And because, you know, time and time again, especially in the Middle East, that is a history that does not inspire optimism, does not inspire confidence, where every Islamic movement in the Middle East has been beaten, has been dismantled before it really acquired the strength to do anything significant. And I think that is the first thing. We need patience. We need to build our inner strength. We need to mobilize our own societies. And this action, which is now being projected of Muslim militants going out and attacking Western targets or United States, this is a sign of our weakness. This is a sign of our inability to confront the real problems at its source, that is in our countries. It is because we have failed to do our homework. You know, there is a wonderful sentence which summarizes the essence of a successful resistance, which you will find in Iqbal Ahmed, one of the leading thinkers from Pakistan, who was a secular thinker, but nevertheless we can learn a great deal from him, which was, you do not outfight your enemy, you out-administer him. Let us learn to out-administer our enemy. That requires thinking. That requires strategy, that requires patience, that requires organization, grassroots work. And we need to do it in our homes.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to answer that question, but I'm reminded of a beautiful shail, two lines from Muhammad Iqbal, the poet philosopher from India, Pakistan. And it's in Urdu. Very few probably do understand Urdu, but I'll try my rough translation. And this was Iqbal wrote these lines when the Ottomans were defeated in World War I. He says, Agar Usmaniyon par kohi gham tuta, to kya gham hai? Ki khune sag hazar anjum se hoti hai sahar paida. Let's not cry on the mountains of grief that have crushed the Ottomans. Hundreds and thousands of stars die, but they are followed by the dawn of a morning of hope. So let's remain optimistic that a new morning will dawn for Muslims and for the rest of humanity also. Next question, please.
My name is Yunus Mirza. I just would like to have Dr. Fadl expand on his last point about the issue we Muslims need to go on beyond the idea that Islam is for peace against violence. And if you could give some examples, it would be very helpful.
Okay. I mean, I don't, you know, I can't claim to be a scholar of comparative theology, but I'm very confident in saying that Muslim theology has tremendous respect for individual human beings and the freedom of thought and their conscience and their ability to understand transcendental truth and moral truth and act in accordance with it, right? And so it has tremendous respect for individuals and individuality and is very tolerant, right, of individuals' abilities to do that. And matter of fact, it obliges us, right, to exercise our moral judgment and our moral sense and our reason. You know, for example, many of our theologians said that assent to our creed without a rational basis is not effective. That's the position of many of our theologians, right? So we have, our tradition has tremendous respect for the dignity of human beings, right? And this is what we need to tap into so we can live here as productive citizens and as equal citizens. Right. Now, I agree with many of the observations of my colleague next to me, but I don't view myself, I'm not waiting for Egypt to get better for me to live a productive life, right? And I think one of the great sublime ironies, right, is even as all these things are being done to places where I come from, right, the result of that is that Muslims are coming here, right? And so it's sort of a maybe just the way that history works. And so I think it's very important for us to act here in a way that's responsible and consistent with Islam, right, as opposed to trying to put up some sort of defensive shields and then hiding, right? We have nothing to hide from, and we should just, you know, speak openly about things because, you know, it's anybody that says Islam is a religion of peace, right, is not being intellectually honest in the sense that we're not the Quakers, right? On the other hand, we're not the Mongols either, right? And nor is anybody else. And so we should not be ashamed of the fact that our religion permits us to bear arms in certain circumstances. That should not be a cause of shame, right? It's not a cause of shame for the United States government. Why should it embarrass me, right? And so we have to talk honestly and openly about, you know, issues of political violence, as our colleague was up here, right? Everybody, right, wants, recognizing in certain circumstances that political violence is necessary. So why do you want to think? Why are you looking for Muslims to become pacifists when you would never accept that for yourself,
mm-hmm.
right? So we should neither we should never pretend to be who we aren't. Because people will recognize that we have, and they will draw inferences, negative inferences against you, right? When you say things that they think you're just saying to please them. So, you know, we have nothing to hide, right? And we should just talk openly about things. If we have disagreements, we just talk about them, right? There's nothing contrary to the Islamic tradition about having disagreements about things. Matter of fact, that's probably the central tenet of our ethical theory about disagreement and how to work through it, right? And so we shouldn't run from this. We shouldn't have artificial demands of unity on, you know, A through Z about Islam, and then, you know, try to terrorize people into adopting some type of Islamic party line, right? This is what gets us in trouble, right?
Thank you very much. Last question, please.
And comments and Dr. Bandura's presentation. The question I have is, how would you reconcile or explain the just war theory and peaceful underpinnings of Islam with the current or prevailing political condition and leadership within and among Muslim countries? Is all of this just driven by political ambition and
are you talking about, you know, what is causing the what's the causes of the malaise that was being described here?
Yes.
Well, that, I mean, people write books and books and books about that, but you know, in my humble opinion, you know, to put it prosaically, Muslims sort of face a Humpty Dumpty problem, right? When Humpty Dumpty falls, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again, right? And, you know, the modern state was not something that emerged organically or spontaneously within Muslim societies. Muslim political politics had a very different history, right? So we shouldn't be surprised that there's a lot of friction and trying to create this new institution and indigenize it and have it assimilated into the Muslim world. And then, of course, there are there are internal factors, but there are also, I think, very important geopolitical factors in the international arena as well. And, you know, again, I'm an Arab, and I believe very strongly that the resolution of World War I and the division of the Arab world and the 21 different countries, etc., certainly did not help things. As a matter of fact, I will go on record and say Al-Qaeda would not exist today, right, if the Arabs had gotten what they wanted after World War I. I'm certain of that. I mean, we can't go back in time and rerun history, but I will believe that until I meet God, right? And so, you know, the Arabs did not want the creation of these countries, these, you know, like, for example, Saudi Arabia. Traditionally, you know, this region was, you know, under the influence of I guess the more developed countries in the area, right? And so, you know, it's not unfair to point out that a lot of the structural political problems in the Middle East are the direct result of colonial map makers. It's not unfair to say that. But that's not meant to deny that there are also internal problems in the Muslim world as well, especially the Arab world. I just don't know enough about Africa to comment on this.
You talk about leadership, and you hit the nail right on the head. And if Muslim leaders just try to follow a little bit, not even everything, how the Prophet lived his life, how he led, and became a statesman, less problems. So in answer to your question, I'll share a story with you. It will take 1 minute, and then I think that will be the end of this discourse. From the Marabu Muslims in Senegal. They say when God created the world, he gave Muslims everything. He gave them oil, gas. The African Muslim countries, he gave them all the animals. You can think about good rivers. They don't need to air condition their homes. Nice weather, diamonds, you name it. So all the other folks started complaining. First, the Europeans came to God, how come he give Muslims all this black gold, oil, and all these riches, and all this nice weather and continent in Africa and all over the world, and you put us in the frozen tundra? All we could do is tattoo ourselves in our caves. God said, who is next? The Chinese came. Here we are in China, all we have is panda beers, and we are cold and all these things. All we have to do is eat chop suey. Why did you do this to us? They say, who is next? Everybody came and laid their complaint. And God said, you think you guys have problems? Wait till you see the Muslim leaders. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you'll all join me in thanking the panelists. Let me repeat the announcements. Dinner will be served in the room, and please follow the sign. Not dinner, lunch, sorry. Don't stay for dinner. There is a prayer area available in room 608. Please follow the sign, and we will reconvene here in this room at 2 p.m. Thank you very much.